I am Fran Storch, and this is Radio Naturopath, and you'll be with us for the next hour. We're here with you. We would love to have you participate in our show. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, and you can email us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. So we would love to hear from you.
All of those things.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So, we have some interesting stuff. One of the things that came up is there was an NPR article where they were questioning whether Connecticut naturopaths should be allowed to prescribe pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is absolutely they should. I would think, right? Wouldn't you want that to a certain extent? Aren't there things that you could use in your naturopathic practice?
Let's put it this way. The fact that naturopathic physicians are not allowed to do certain things, not all things, but certain things that MDs are allowed to do is, in my estimation, it's kind of like... I don't know if I should go there because it's going to be controversial.
That's okay. I mean, it's public radio,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
It's like, let's put it this way. It's like saying, should women be allowed to be doctors? Let's debate the pros and cons.
Oh, dear.
It's that bad. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, you have a soapbox, so go.
Yeah. So you would think that as a naturopathic physician, I would think that we shouldn't be allowed to prescribe pharmaceuticals or we shouldn't want to. And the truth is, we don't. We don't exactly want to. We do and we don't at the same time. The issue with us prescribing pharmaceuticals is that we are trained to do it. People think that we're not trained to do it, and we are. We get extensive pharmaceutical training in prescribing pharmaceuticals. The other piece that you may not know is that in most of the licensed jurisdictions in the U.S., we are allowed to prescribe. We have a formulary. Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, they all have formularies. So the three other New England states where we have a license, we can prescribe. So does it make sense that Connecticut is a holdout? And Connecticut is, in fact, a holdout. What happens when pharmaceutical companies or when naturopathic physicians get a licensing law newly, like in the last decade or two, they get a formulary. And Connecticut, the problem with Connecticut is Connecticut got its law in 1923. It's a long time ago. We've had the same law since then. We've been trying off and on and with gathering fervor and vigor to try to get a formulary. And one of our great naturopathic physicians in this state, Rick Leva, has been very active in trying to push the law through, that we've been trying to get a statute through. One of the problems is we don't have as many naturopathic physicians in this state as we could. One of the reasons naturopathic physicians don't stay is because we feel like sometimes we're practicing with our hands tied behind our back. The thing we're not allowed to do all of the things we're trained to do. One of the things we're trained to do is prescribed pharmaceuticals. We're trained with extra training to do obstetrics, that we can deliver babies, and we're also trained to do minor surgery. In this state, we are not allowed to break the skin for therapeutic purposes, only for diagnostic purposes. So I can draw blood from you. I can draw blood from you. I can diagnose you with Lyme disease, but once you have the Lyme disease, I can't give you a pharmaceutical to treat it, even though I know exactly how to do it.
Well, that's frustrating.
Right. And so Lyme disease is one of those illnesses that we would like to be able to prescribe for, because when we prescribe, we treat Lyme disease. We treat chronic Lyme. And a lot of MDs don't want to treat chronic Lyme because their cohorts don't permit it. You know, we have the issue of the IDSA having a strict protocol by which Lyme, they say that Lyme is hard to catch and easy to treat, which we all know isn't true. And we know that people suffer with chronic Lyme and we want to be able to treat it. So we want to be able to get antibiotics to treat it as we see fit. And naturopathic physicians support each other in doing that. So the other thing that we see is, as I said, there are certain pharmaceuticals we want to be able to prescribe that MDs aren't as likely to prescribe because, you know, so where sometimes MDs get heavily marketed to by pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical reps come in and they give them lots of samples and they encourage them to prescribe pharmaceuticals from their company, just like supplement companies come in and they try to encourage us to sell their supplements.
Right.
And so physicians are very likely to prescribe things that their MDs, that the reps come in and suggest to them if they think it's a reasonable drug. There are certain drugs that don't make a lot of money for pharmaceutical companies and that are more naturally based. So one good example of that is natural thyroid hormone, whether it's Armour or Westroid or Natrathroid. They are thyroid hormones that are extracted from the glands of animals, from thyroid glands of animals. Natrathroid is extracted from cows, and Armour Thyroid and Westroid are extracted from pigs. And we can't prescribe those. Now, they're considered to be prescriptions, so we can't prescribe them. However, they're natural thyroid hormone, and they're different from prescribing just something like Synthroid or levothyroxine or even Tyrosint or Levoxyl, which are only T4. And T4 prescribed by itself doesn't always work for people. Often it does, but it doesn't always work for people. And I have so many patients with thyroid issues who get prescribed only T4. Their numbers fall into line, but they still feel awful. And then once a wise person is able to prescribe either synthetic T3 for them or prescribe whole thyroid for them, then they do in fact feel better. So we want to be able to prescribe, I would like to be able to prescribe natural thyroid hormone, and I would also like to be able to prescribe synthetic thyroid hormone because some people do better on it. There's some controversy about whether you have an autoimmune thyroid condition. When you have something like Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Graves' disease, there's some who think that if you put natural thyroid hormone into that person's body, you can create a situation where antibodies will be created to that thyroid hormone. So you don't want to encourage that. So those people should be given synthetic thyroid hormone because there's no thyroid gland in it. And there's only the chemicals. And sometimes that's the right thing to do. So we would like to be able to prescribe Synthroid or Tyrosint or, you know, one of the gluten-free T4s, as well as Cytomel or Leothyronine, which is synthetic T3. We'd also like to be able to prescribe something like sustained release T3, which is a great idea because T3 is very powerful. When you prescribe it, people can get really wired and the body wasn't really designed to take on a very heavy dose of T3 really quickly. So if you give sustained release, it's released over time. So we like to access compounding pharmacies to get pharmaceuticals prescribed in a sane way. And sometimes there are creative things that we want to do. And, you know, in the states where we can access compounding pharmacies love us because we work well together with them.
Sure. And in Vermont and Maine, you can do this.
That's right.
So
yeah.
if you are a naturopath in Vermont or Maine, you write prescriptions.
That's right.
And you guys spend 4 years in medical school, just like a doctor MD does.
And we get extensive pharmacy training,
right,
just like family practice doctors do.
But apparently, there's a statement here in the article that was out about this most recently. And there's an ophthalmologist for the Connecticut State Medical Society said that naturopathic training doesn't give students enough real-world clinical exposure that's needed to effectively prescribe modern drugs. He said that MDs get that during internship and residencies. Fire away. Go.
He's right. It's true.
Okay.
And the thing is, if we were allowed to prescribe pharmaceuticals, we would get that. It's that simple. That's all. Well,
that's
of course
the real
not.
World training that we're talking about.
Well, we can't. Well, it's a catch-22. We're not allowed to prescribe, so we don't have residencies and clinical training and internships where we can prescribe. So we don't get real world training in prescribing. All right, it's a silly statement. If we were allowed to prescribe, we would get that training. And in fact, this is probably not true. When you get your clinical training in Oregon, Washington, or Arizona, where they're all allowed to prescribe. So if you're in clinic in Arizona, you can prescribe. So you do get that clinical. So
right.
It's true. It may be true at the University of Bridgeport. I'm not sure. I think that because the law is such in the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine, they certainly get pharmaceutical training. I don't know that they get to prescribe, but they do in Oregon, Washington, and at Southwest in Arizona.
So
they get pharmacy training. So what he's saying is not true for the licensed states where we are trained. It's just not true.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
So he
says here that you need to have better clinics and that you don't have those. They need to find ways of collaborating better with MDs and bridging the gap.
Okay. We're trying all the time to bridge gaps. I have a lot of gaps bridged with a lot of local MDs, the ones who send lots of patients to me. Perhaps he would like to bridge some gaps.
Yeah,
there you go. With naturopaths. Maybe he should be reaching out to naturopaths to get them more of that training. That would be really helpful. We would really appreciate that.
Well, that particular person is an ophthalmologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an encounter with an ophthalmologist. Names are set aside here. And I was having a problem with a reoccurring infection in my eye, and because of various reasons. But anyway, I was told that I was to go on to some sort of a steroid.
Yes.
And when I asked how long I had to be on it, the answer was for the rest of your life, that you have to stay on the steroid. And I said, I got to think about that. And I was given a script, and I was sent home. And I came back, and who did I talk to but my local friendly naturopath?
Well, before you talk to your friendly local naturopath, what happened to you when you were taking that steroid?
Oh, I'm not sure I remember exactly.
I do.
Yeah.
You didn't feel good. You had stomach upset.
Yeah, that's true.
And you're very
sensitive.
And
I'm real sensitive, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But
so you were going to, this person was suggesting you take those steroid eye drops for the rest of your life, and you were ready. Within a week, you were having an upset stomach.
Right.
That makes sense.
So my friendly natural medicine doctor told me, let's try this instead. And so we went for a different idea with some supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had a problem, and this was a recurring problem. This happened It happened, and then 6 months later, it happened again.
Yeah.
And then, it kept coming back. And I haven't had a problem for over 2 years now.
Yeah.
Maybe 3 years.
I mean, it's kind of getting off the track. But that was an exciting case because the year you got it, I raised my hand at the New Hampshire conference, and I asked for advice. And people gave me some advice. And then I went home. What you had is you have a corneal implant. And you've had
your corneal
implant for how many years? 35 years, something like that?
At least.
Yeah. So because you had an accident, a really nasty accident with a screwdriver.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you had to
40 years now.
Yep. So you had to have a corneal implant. And so corneal implant, it's somebody else's cornea.
Right.
And you wound up getting iritis. And, so after all that time, your body said, I don't think so. And started making antibodies to it, we think, because you got an inflammation in your iris.
Right.
We think it was iritis or anyway.
Yeah, that's what it was. That's what I was diagnosed as, was
that's
iritis.
Right. Yep. So you had an iritis. So, of course, iritis can be caused by infections and autoimmune conditions. So the ophthalmologist checked you for those. He checked you to see if you had an elevated ANA and an elevated rheumatoid factor, and you did not, yay.
Mm-hmm.
And he also checked you to see if, guess what, if you had syphilis or gonorrhea.
Yes.
Because gonorrhea is, there's a condition called lover's heel. And lover's heel will be, because gonorrhea is a sexually transmitted disease, you get an inflammation in your heel. You get a heel spur that gets inflamed in your heel.
That's funny.
And you can also get iritis at the same time. So we tested you for those things. And hooray, you didn't have any of those.
Didn't have that.
You didn't have anything. And you didn't have any abnormal antibodies. All you had was this inflammation in your eye. And he gave you the steroid drops. I'm not sure if he gave you something else anti-inflammatory.
It was just that.
And said, take this forever.
Yeah.
And I said, no. And I gave you a combination product that had things like curcumin and boswellia and rosemary. It was an NF-kappa-B modulator. So it reduced inflammatory compounds in your body without being a steroid and without giving you the side effects of a steroid. I gave you that. And I also gave you another compound that was a really high-quality combination compound for eye stuff, and it had beta carotene and lots of vitamin C and bilberry and lutein and zeaxanthin, all kinds of things that are really good for your
natural stuff,
your eyes. Yeah. And you took two pills of each of those a day.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did you get better, but you had hemorrhoids and they went away.
Well, that was from something else.
No, you told me that.
Hmm. Okay.
And I remember this very clearly because it was so exciting because you went off the steroids and we gave you those products and it was a funny side effect that your hemorrhoids also got better because it reduced inflammation in your digestive system as well. It doesn't care where the inflammation is. It's gonna help you
wherever it is. Right?
Well, and also the eye stuff is looking at collagen and circulation in the eyes. But you had issues with collagen and circulation in your tuchus, and you got better.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
And it was a great case, and I raised my hand. I think they clapped. At the following year, I went back to the NHAND, and I told the story, and I think they clapped. It got a cheer.
I was put on this earth to amuse you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also for me to help with your, because you have certain medical conditions,
oh,
so
absolutely.
I can practice on you.
No, it's
I practice
a good thing.
On me. So the thing is, when Ron or I get a condition, it's always an opportunity to practice on ourselves to see what works.
There you go.
Now I'm practicing on menopause. It's exciting.
Yeah, that's been real exciting.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, so the thing is that was really kind of getting off the track, and that's speaking to is the support of why naturopathic physicians are helpful, but it's not really speaking to why we should prescribe.
Right.
So why we should prescribe is, so one of the things you'll find is thyroid is a big one, and people really like to come to us to get their thyroid tested, especially people with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, but people with other thyroid conditions as well, because we're very holistic about how we approach thyroid treatment. And MDs often, not all the time, but often will give you just T4 because they're afraid to give you T3. The reason they're afraid to give you T3 is because T3 is very powerful. It's very stimulating. It's much more potent than T4. What they're hoping is that your body is going to have a good rate of conversion of T4 to T3. But naturopathic physicians will follow you a lot more closely and will also measure your free T3 and T4 and your total T3 and T4. Measure your antibodies, measure your thyroid binding globulin. We're consistent about measuring a lot more stuff and also treating you holistically and finding out what's your stress like. One of the things you need to have healthy thyroid function is a well-functioning liver, and we're very good at helping you with that sort of thing. So, but some people do need a prescription. They do need either synthetic or natural thyroid supplementation. And we want to be able to prescribe that. Another area that we want to prescribe is bioidentical hormones. One of the problems with the naturally based prescription drugs is the pharmaceutical companies don't make a lot of money on them. So a lot of the docs don't get presented with them, so they don't prescribe them.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's one of the issues. So not a lot of research is done. That's one of the complaints about Lyme disease, that pharmaceutical companies don't want to develop more antibiotics because they think there are enough antibiotics already, and prescribing long-term antibiotics as drugs are relatively inexpensive. They're not always inexpensive, but they're relatively inexpensive. Doxycycline and amoxicillin, which are two big pharmaceuticals that you prescribe for Lyme disease, are pretty cheap. So,
yeah.
So long-term prescription of them, you know, that they're not as interested in doing research on those and pushing more research on necessary antibiotics, particularly to treat Lyme disease. So that's another one that we're concerned about. And then bioidentical hormones, that's another one. So bioidentical hormones, again, because they're natural substances, they're not very expensive. You can get inexpensive, naturally based bioidentical hormones, meaning your estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. You can get those in the exact form that they're found in humans, and they're relatively inexpensive. So they're not pushed by, again, pharmaceutical companies don't push them, so they're not presented to the MDs by the reps, and that's what happens. But we don't care. We want you to get well, so we're going to follow first do no harm. We're going to give you the least harmful thing possible to help you with your healing, and we're going to also give you what works, and we don't have a judgment about what works. Most naturopathic physicians, I don't know. This is how I operate. If you come to see me, I am not interested in making a profit. I mean, I kind of am, but I'm not as interested in making a profit off a particular supplement or drug as I am about you getting well. That I'm very ethical that way, and naturopathic physicians are trained to be ethical that way. Your major success is helping the patient to get well, whatever that takes. And if it means all you tell them is to go home and cuddle with their spouse more, and then that does it. You're proud of yourself. And you know what else? If you give them something that really, really helps them to health, you would think that, well, you heal yourself out of a job. But you know what? There's not enough naturopathic physicians in Connecticut to worry about that. So we just keep doing the best job that we possibly can, taking good care of our patients, providing good customer service, listening to our patients, working hard to figure out what's going on with our patients, spending time with our patients. And they just keep, not only do they keep coming back, but they bring their whole families in and they keep sending people. So we don't worry about, is making a profit, making a profit off a particular treatment or supplement. I mean, you might want to add things to your business to make it more lucrative. But my number one satisfaction is helping you get well, help and figuring out what's going on with you and working through it. And so in terms of prescribing pharmaceuticals, so I said there are certain pharmaceuticals we want to be able to prescribe. That you want to be able, your patient trusts you and loves you and wants to come in and wants you to diagnose their Lyme disease. You don't want to have to send them to an MD who not only may or may not agree that the person has Lyme disease, but may not give them enough of a course to help the illness. And so that's why our patients love us. And so in Connecticut, it's very frustrating. We certainly know how to prescribe pharmaceuticals for Lyme disease, and we study it so much, and our continuing ed. Personally, I go to the New Hampshire conference every year, and New Hampshire conference has half the CEUs are on pharmacy, so we learn pharmaceuticals, and so I'm getting, even though I'm not required to have continuing ed at this time in Connecticut, I have it. I get it anyway, and you better believe that if I had a formulary all of a sudden, I'd be studying all the time. And the requirement, now we were trained to do pharmacy when I was in school. Of course, I was in school from 91 to 95, and so of course I would have to have a refresher course, which I would be happy to do. I would be happy to have a refresher course and then take a test, and I would certainly be fully willing to do that. And in fact, in pushing for the new statute or the revision of the current statute so that we can prescribe in the state of Connecticut, that's what we want. We're saying we want to have CEUs. We want to have CEUs in pharmacy. We are willing to take a course to re-up our knowledge of pharmacy and then take a test. We're happy to do that. And so so it seems very fair. And like we said, that states, most of the states in the United States that are licensed have a formulary. And most of the states in the United States were licensed after us, including Oregon and Washington. We got our law in 1923 because a naturopathic physician helped somebody who was in the legislature. And so they pushed a law through. But we haven't been... We haven't been able to get the law changed since that time. Hmm. And it's because we are blocked. We are obstructed by the Connecticut State Medical Society. That's what's going on. Not only that, we don't have enough of an infrastructure. At any given time, we have around 200 naturopathic physicians practicing in the state of Connecticut because we don't have the infrastructure that MDs have. And some naturopaths decide that they feel like they can't practice all of the things that they learn. So they leave. They go to other states. That's what happens. And we got three states that are within shouting distance of here, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. We also got Maryland and D.C. if you want to go south. And they're not that far from here, and people move, especially to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. And that's what happens. So we lose naturopathic physicians here. Now, I've got a good gig going. I'm able to help people with what I'm able to do. I would like to be able to prescribe. I worked for a pharmaceutical company before I became a naturopathic physician. So I have pharmacological experience there in the understanding of drugs and how they work. But the other thing that we want to be able to do is manage our patients' polypharmacy. And polypharmacy is something that we see all the time. We have many patients who come in who are on many pharmaceuticals, and the pharmaceuticals are additive. You have people who are on three or four blood pressure medications all at the same time. You want to be able to manage that. You want to be able to question whether they really should be on that statin drug, and is there something natural that you can do to help them instead? And you want to be able to manage the drugs that people are on and perhaps pull them off. I can't legally take you off a drug right now because another doc prescribed it and I don't have prescribing authority. So right now, if you come to me and say, I really want to get off my omeprazole, I can help you to do that, but I have to legally say to you, you need to discuss this with the doctor that prescribed this to you. And then I give you things that can help you get off it, but I can't say to you, yes, get off the omeprazole. Omeprazole being a proton pump inhibitor that helps with heartburn and gastroesophageal reflux disorder.
No, but what you can do is you can help your patient along, and if their results get better with what you're doing, then they can go back to their MD and say, hey, I'm doing something else and it seems to be working better.
That's right. And
the patient can wean themselves off of something. Is that
yeah,
not
they can
correct?
Make, sure, they can make that decision themselves, but you right. have to say to them, listen, go to your doctor and talk about this. And something like a proton pump inhibitor, if the patient doesn't also do all the things that you need to do, because there's a reason why they have gastroesophageal reflux, and if they're eating a food that's not working for them, or if they're under a lot of stress, or both, they have to work on that. And we can right. also give substances that reduce inflammation and improve function in the digestive system that are not acid blockers. So we can do that concomitantly with the giving of the pharmaceutical. And so it's not harmful, for example, to give deglycyrrhizinated licorice, which is a substance that helps with gastroesophageal reflux and heartburn. You can give that at the same time that you are that somebody's taking a proton pump inhibitor, because all it does is reduce inflammation and improve the quality of the mucosal lining of the digestive system, and it doesn't block stomach acid. So it's not working counter to an acid blocker. In fact, some products have deglycyrrhizinated licorice along with sodium bicarbonate in it to help with that. That's not a direction I like to go, but that is something that people do. So.
Right. So, and, you know, I have a friend who he's on beta blockers, I think is what it is, mm-hmm. and because of a condition, and he has, like, slowly kind of weaned himself away from it because he's doing some different things, both food-wise and also athletically, and his numbers are improving.
Right.
So, you know, there's a question of, you know, of whether or not there are other alternatives out there. And the reason he has gone in this direction is because he found that his performance on his bicycle was so drastically changed by
sure.
by the beta blockers.
Right.
Because, you know, you can only get your heart rate up so high.
That's right.
It's like a governor for your heart.
Yes.
You know, so it just holds you down. And he felt miserable because
yeah.
of it, not to mention all the other side effects that he was having from
it. Well, beta blockers are tough. And I don't see, I will see people come in on beta blockers, but I don't see it as frequently because people don't tolerate them that well. And if you're athletic at all, one of the problems with beta blockers is it slows your heart rate down. This is what it is. So what beta blocker means is you have receptors in your body called adrenergic receptors. They receive adrenaline or epinephrine or norepinephrine, whatever, depending on what country you're in. Adrenaline is used colloquially in the U.S., but it is used officially in Britain. They say adrenaline and noradrenaline. The physicians and, you know, people in science say adrenaline and noradrenaline in Britain. And here we see epinephrine and norepinephrine. Mm. I think one's Greek and one's Latin and whatever. It's the same stuff. Anyway, so these neurotransmitters, they bond to certain receptors and they have certain effects. So you have alpha adrenergic receptors and beta adrenergic receptors. So if you have an alpha adrenergic receptor, it tends to calm things down. It tends to promote rest and digest. So alpha adrenergic receptors, if you have something that increases alpha adrenergic function, you're going to have, you're going to urinate more, you're going to go to the bathroom more. If you block those things, if you block alpha adrenergic receptors, you're going to, the opposite's going to happen. Things are going to slow down. So beta adrenergic receptors wire you out. They tend to block your rest and digest and up your fight or flight. So you get beta agonists, for example. So, you know, you folks that have asthma or you have bronchitis or COPD, you're given inhalers and you're often given albuterol. And albuterol is a beta agonist. What it does is it stimulates the beta receptors. So it speeds up your heart rate. It opens up your blood vessels. It opens up your lungs so that you can breathe better. And it increases your fight or flight. And some of you may notice that when you take your albuterol, you get a racing heart. That's one of the side effects. Mm. It revs you up. And if you take it too close to bedtime, you might have trouble sleeping. So if you take a beta blocker, that drug is going to block that receptor. It's going to stop all of those effects. So it slows your heart rate down. It closes down blood vessels so they're not so active. It reduces blood pressure and it reduces your pulse rate. And it will, because it's reducing your pulse rate, it can also regularize heart rhythm. So if somebody's in a really bad way, that can be really helpful. But the problem is when you want to be athletic, you want your blood pressure to go up. Your systolic blood pressure, the pressure that pushes blood into the rest of your body for use, needs to go up. That's normal. It's normal for it to go up, and it can go up as high as 180 to 200. That's fine. But it's not going to do that if you're on a beta blocker. And so the other thing is because, you know, if you're just sitting here hanging out, you know, not doing much, and you then go and walk from here to stand up and go walk from here to there, you need your blood pressure to rise rather quickly so you can walk from here to there. If you're on a beta blocker, you might get dizzy when that happens because you can't get your blood pressure up fast enough to account for the increased circulation you need just to walk from, you know, from here into the lobby.
Right. Otherwise known as head rush.
That's right, because your blood pressure stays low. Mm-hmm. And then people who try to work out on beta blockers, they find that they can't get their heart rate enough to get the circulation that they need.
Sure.
And so that's what you see. So what we want to be able to do is help to modify that, you know, help people with diet and lifestyle changes so that they can get their blood pressure down. And then if they absolutely can't, we want to be able to help them. We want to use judicious doses of pharmaceuticals and probably not beta blockers because beta blockers have that effect. People often don't feel well on blood pressure medications. It makes them sleepy. It makes them tired. It makes them feel draggy. It can even make them feel depressed. If you can't get circulation to your brain, you're going to be a little depressed.
Sure. Sure.
So that's one of the things that you see. Just people feel generally slowed down by them. So if you have high blood pressure, it's really in your interest to figure out a way to get it down naturally, because otherwise you have to take pharmaceuticals. Because you can't walk around with super high blood pressure all the time, because the big risk is that you're going to get a stroke.
Right.
Because it's the brain that has the tiny little blood vessels that you, if you get that high blood pressure all the time, you get turbulent flow, and then you're more likely to get banging around in the arteries, which then need to be repaired, and they get repaired by calcium and cholesterol and platelets, and you get blockages. Mm-hmm. So then if you get a high rate of flow over that atherosclerosis, you can break blood vessels, and that's how you get a stroke. So it's important to keep your blood pressure in a healthy range. If you keep your arteries clear, you're less likely to get a stroke. And by getting regular exercise, that helps that.
So if you are a person who has been diagnosed with high blood pressure and you want to monitor it very carefully, you know, we have all these great things now. You know, we can wear heart rate monitors and we can tell what our heart rate's doing, and we can check and test things on our own to kind of, if you want to get really involved with that, is there a way of checking your own blood pressure?
Of course. Yeah.
How would you do that if
you're
at home?
Very easily. Oh gosh, you can go to the drugstore. Drugstores have them, and the drugstore and the internet. You can very easily buy blood pressure cuffs for home use. You can buy blood pressure cuffs for home use that have an arm cuff. Mm-hmm. So usually when you're measuring blood pressure, you're measuring it on the brachial artery, which is an artery. So folks, if you're not driving, you can stick your arm out with your palm facing up, and you see your bicep muscle in the upper part of your upper extremity, right? So here's your bicep muscle. So touch the middle of your bicep muscle and then go down and inward towards your body. So if you press in there under your bicep muscle inside, you will find the brachial artery. And that is the artery that your doctor usually tests your blood pressure on. And you can do that yourself. You can get a cuff, an electronic cuff that has a that goes around your brachial artery. And you push a button and you sit there and it'll measure blood pressure for you. An even easier way to do it is to get a wrist cuff, because the wrist cuff's very easy to put around your arm. You press a little button and it'll test your blood pressure.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, in your radial artery. I find those really useful because some of my patients have very large arms, and if their arms are really large, I can't get the large adult cuff around them. The cuffs, you put them around and they Velcro on. And if the patient's arm is too big, it's a lot easier to use a wrist cuff. So I finally bought a wrist cuff and I use those. And then some people have reasons why I can't do the blood pressure in their arms that don't have to do with size. Like I have a patient who has kidney failure and she gets dialysis. So the veins in her arms are pretty, she has a lot of swollen veins. So I'll do the blood pressure cuff in her wrist there. Some people have had surgeries. So women with breast cancer have had lymph nodes removed. And also people, I have a patient who has melanoma who had lymph nodes removed. And so I can't do blood pressure in her brachial artery. So I do it on her wrist instead. Or I do it on, sometimes you just do it on the other arm. And sometimes people just have pain. You know, they've had shoulder surgery. Or they've had something. They have some reason why you can't do it in the brachial artery. So you have another option. You can do it on the wrist. You can do blood pressure on a person's ankle too, or their leg. Anywhere you can get to an artery, you can do blood pressure. So you absolutely can monitor. Anyone can monitor it at home.
Right. Last time I went to the eye doctor, they put one on my wrist. Right. And it was like, hey, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's just a different thing.
I have one at the office. You can buy them.
Do you?
You can buy them at CVS. You can
really?
Buy them at the drugstore. Sure. If you want one, we can get one.
It would seem that if you had a blood pressure problem, you'd want to kind of have one of those handy.
Sure. Yeah. And I try to encourage people, if I'm helping someone with their blood pressure, I do encourage them to get one of those and then give me a diary. And so we can see what's going on. Because, you know, a lot of times people go into the doctor's office and they're nervous about getting their blood pressure checked. So the anxiety will raise your epinephrine, and your norepinephrine raises your blood pressure. So you get that white coat syndrome, although I never wear a white coat. I am very, very happy to have a lovely acupuncturist in my office now named Traver Garrity, and she does wear a white coat, which is totally cool. That's her choice. The thing with wearing a white coat, wearing a lab coat when you're practicing, is you have big pockets. There's places to put stuff.
It's like wearing an apron.
So it's utilitarian. So she probably is comfortable doing that because they had her do that in clinic, and she found that, you know, she has to carry needles. She has to carry stuff in and out of the room, so it's probably convenient for her. And I choose not. I don't really need to wear the white coat because she has to leave the room when the person's having their acupuncture treatment.
Right. Well, she has more tools.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So it's like wearing an apron. You would have tools, and you know, the people I call on at bicycle shops all wear aprons, put their tools in. So
handy. Exactly. And I don't really need that because everything I need, I stay in the office with the patient the whole time, except for if they're changing. And if I got a barrier, I could stay in the room. We got one of those nice Asian barriers.
You one of those.
Yeah, I'm not sure where we put it. The problem I have is the
a folding one.
No, I know, but I don't know where we would set it up because I have the gynecological table, the exam table, and then I also have the massage table. It would be cramped. Doesn't really work.
Well,
yeah. You'd have to sit.
We'll explore that.
Yeah, you have to set it up and put it. But there are offices where if they're big enough, you have a spot where you can put the like my friend Shannon, who's an acupuncturist in Lebanon, she's got one of those. And so when you want to change, you go behind that. But she has a little corner that works for her.
Right.
Where you go behind that, she's got a little chair in there and a mirror.
Right.
And, you know, you can fix yourself when you're getting dressed, and it's nice.
That's important.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it is. Because you're lying down, your hair gets messed up.
These blood pressure monitors, these wrist ones, are very affordable.
Yeah,
also.
I know.
That's really kind of a cool thing.
They are. They're inexpensive.
So if you want to learn more about your blood pressure, you can kind of do your own thing.
You can get them at most drugstores have them. You can go into a drugstore and buy one, and you can also get them online. They're easy to find. Yeah. So anyway, right. So in my estimation, naturopathic physicians should be able to prescribe because I believe we get plenty of training to do it. Generally, our formularies are not as extensive as the formularies of MDs, but I don't care to prescribe everything anyway. The things I really want to prescribe, like I said, I want to be able to prescribe any kind of thyroid medicine I want. I want to be able to prescribe antibiotics. Because sometimes if you've had strep for 3 weeks and I diagnose it, I'm like, you know what? Take a few days of amoxicillin. That way we're sure you're not going to get rheumatic condition or scarlet fever. So I'd like to be able to prescribe antibiotics. I want to prescribe antibiotics for Lyme disease. Hello. If my patient comes in and has pneumonia, maybe I'd like to prescribe the antibiotic instead of them having to go to the hospital.
Right.
And
because aren't they getting like double dipped in fees that way too?
Oh,
so they're having to pay twice.
So the other piece is that the family practice doctor is a dying breed. Even naturopathic physicians are finding that it's good if they specialize. I actually don't want to. I'm very eclectic. I like treating lots of things. Having said that, there are certain conditions I like to treat a lot of. I like to help athletes with, people who are high-level athletes. I like to help them with their training and nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
I like to help people lose weight.
Right.
I like to help with thyroid. I'm really big on thyroid. I like to help people with Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain conditions that I do kind of have a focus on and I want to help people with and I get good results. And I like to help people with digestion, with all kinds of digestive disorders.
So let's back up to the Lyme thing here just for a second, because there's a lot of controversy about Lyme because we don't really know what's going on with Lyme. And that seems to be a big problem is that the CDC has been really big on checking out Zika and throwing millions and billions of dollars at Zika, but they won't address Lyme, which it seems more people are having problems with Lyme in this country than will ever have a problem with Zika.
Sure.
That is frustrating to me because we've got something that's very obviously at, I would say, epidemic levels because of the number of people that are carrying Lyme in their bodies. And then you get the naysayers, and the naysayers here are talking about how long-term use of antibiotics has been proven to not work. Let's get your take on that one.
Well, if you talk to people who have Lyme disease, they disagree with that.
I understand that. So the end users, the end users say, but I feel so much better from doing this.
That's right.
And yet the results from supposedly from the research is indicating that it doesn't matter.
But the MDs who are putting out that research aren't treating chronic Lyme. You know, how are they going to know? Because they're not treating it. They're not treating chronic Lyme. The people who are treating chronic Lyme are the ones who are seeing the results. It doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, if you're gonna talk about a doc who's doing long-term antibiotics and seeing results, you're going to have to talk to the Lyme literate doctors who are doing it and see what their results are and see these people. You know, I have patients who come in, unless they're lying, for goodness sakes, and I tend to believe my patients, but my patients come in and they're like, I didn't feel good. My doctor thought I was depressed. My doctor didn't believe me. My doctor finally said, okay, here, have 3 weeks of doxycycline or have 2 weeks of doxycycline.
Mm-hmm.
So I did what he said. I took my 2 weeks of doxycycline. I felt so much better.
Right.
Then I got off the doxycycline, and 2 days later, all my symptoms came back. I went back to the doctor, and the doctor wouldn't give me more antibiotics. I said, but I have all the same symptoms I came to you with 2 weeks ago. And he said, well, you have something else now. So the poor patient has to now scramble. They have to now scramble to find another doctor who will prescribe the same medication to them.
Right.
They get the medication, and they feel better. And what you're supposed to do, what Lyme literate doctors do, is they treat you until you are well. You don't stop treating a patient. If they have the same symptoms, keep treating them. And if you're worried about Clostridium difficile. And you know, I heard this direct from the mouth of Richard Horowitz. Richard Horowitz is one of the students of Dr. Burriscano, you know, and they treat chronic Lyme all the time. Richard Horowitz is a MD who practices in Hyde Park, New York, and he treats lots and lots of chronic Lyme and associated co-infections. And he said, I sat in a lecture with him, and he said, it is much more dangerous to not treat with antibiotics for tick-borne illness than to treat with them, because the lasting neurological effects are much more serious than any than the risk of any infection you're going to get from antibiotics.
Sure.
I rarely see people have problems with the antibiotics, because one of the things naturopaths do is we don't just give antibiotics. We give lots of probiotics. We give probiotics, for example, Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a probiotic yeast that can't be killed by antibacterial antibiotics. And we're always throwing lots of antibiotics at the patient.
Right.
The patient's taking lots, or not antibiotics. We're always giving the patient lots of probiotics. And then if the patient gets a digestive upset from taking the antibiotics, we treat that, and we treat it with herbs.
So I have another question for you.
Yeah.
Okay. The other question is, what about the long-term antibiotic question of we're so heavily antibioticed in this country that antibiotics aren't really working anymore.
Right.
What about that question?
So there, this is an interesting question. So one of the problems is you get prescribed to you get prescribed antibiotics for a condition, but people who, if you're consuming dairy and meats that where the animals have been given antibiotics, you're getting trace amounts of antibiotics in your food all the time. So that's one of the reasons we have antibiotic resistance, is because people are consuming antibiotics every day in their meats and poultry and dairy. You know, that's why it's important to look for animal products that have never been given antibiotics. You
Sure.
will increase your antibiotic resistance by eating those foods. The other thing that you see in this country is people don't eat their veggies.
No.
I see that all the time. So one of the things about eating your fruits and veggies, I mean, there's a million reasons to eat your fruits and veggies. One of the reasons to eat your fruits and veggies is because there are wonderful antioxidants that support your immune system, and there are antimicrobial compounds in plants. Why do you think an organic vegetable? When, if you talk to Brian O'Hara, who's of Tobacco Road, mm-hmm. he will tell you that if you see a really healthy, organically grown vegetable that's grown the way he grows it, with lots of wonderful soil and probiotics and care and the right minerals, and the bugs leave those veggies alone. They go after the ones that are sick.
Right, they go after weak plants.
Yes, so
right.
Because they can mm-hmm. get in easier.
Mm-hmm.
So if you eat those really healthy kind of produce, guess what? You're going to get compounds that resist infection. So it's not about getting stuff that's laden with pesticides and chemical fertilizers. If you eat really healthy organic produce, or produce from the local farms around here that, like, you know, stuff like the way that Brian grows his produce, if they use his kinds of practices, farms like Tobacco Road and like Sweet Acres and Brian and Diane on Bassett's Bridge Road.
Mm-hmm.
They probably have a name of their farm and I can't remember it. Well, sorry, Brian and Diane. We'll find it later.
Yeah, we should work on that.
Yeah, okay.
And we also have another
Shunda
CSA
High Farms,
right up here on Maple Road and stores.
Shunda
yep.
High Farms,
mm-hmm.
yep. All of them, they all grow
Shout out
similarly.
To you guys.
Yes, they all grow similarly, and they grow with really healthful growing practices that include probiotics, composting, crop rotation, minerals in the soil. So their produce is extremely healthy and, by the way, tastes freaking awesome. So so if you eat foods like that, you're less likely to get infections of all sorts because you're eating antimicrobial compounds. The other thing is that so a lot of Americans not only don't eat that kind of produce, they don't eat much produce at all. They're eating a lot of processed food that's depleted of nutrients, so they're much more likely to get sick. If you eat a lot of starch and sugar feeds nasty bacteria and yeast that grow in your digestive system that create compounds that make you sick.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things. That's another reason we have antibiotic resistance. So if you eat meats and poultry that were never given, eat meats, poultry, any animal product at all that was never given antibiotics, you're going to be in much better shape. You're going to be less likely to be exposed to antibiotics that are going to give you antibiotic resistance. You also, if you eat healthful produce, you're going to get antimicrobial compounds. And you also, when you eat healthful produce, you get fiber, and the fiber helps to grow the healthy probiotics in your system. And probiotics all by themselves are antimicrobial. They will help your immune system, and they'll help you fight off bad guys. So if you pair taking antibiotics for a tick-borne illness with eating really, really healthy and taking probiotics, and even if you have to take supplements that are antimicrobial, you can do that too. So you take your berberines or your oregano oil or your other essential oils that are antimicrobial, and you're less likely to get bad bugs while that antibiotic is doing its job of killing off your spirochetes or your Bartonella or your Babesia or whatever you happen to have. That's the other thing with naturopathic physicians. When you are given a pharmaceutical by a naturopathic physician, we don't just give you the pharmaceutical. We treat the whole cause. The pharmaceutical is only one small part of what we do for you, because we're helping you with your diet and your lifestyle. We're probably also giving you supportive supplements. We might be giving you stuff to make it so that you have less impact in terms of your kidneys and liver and your detoxification from the effects of that drug that you're taking. So we don't just say give you a 5-minute visit. Okay, here, take this blood pressure pill. Bye. Okay, thanks. Bye. That's not us. Mm-hmm. We don't really want you to take the blood pressure med. We would like to see you off it. We might have to give it to you because try as we might, you haven't followed our instructions yet, or for whatever reason, your blood pressure, your blood vessels are just at a point where they're just not going to calm down. So you need a low dose of a pharmaceutical. But we can give you the pharmaceutical along with your hawthorn and your magnesium and your fish oil and all of your other things that are going to help lower your blood pressure. And you may not need as high of a dose, because the higher dose of the pharmaceutical, or the more pharmaceuticals you take, the more taxing it is to your liver and kidneys, your organs of detoxification. And so we would prescribe pharmaceuticals, believe it or not, in a holistic fashion. And so those are big reasons why you want us to be able to prescribe. Also, if you come in and you're like, Doc, I'm on polypharmacy, I would like to come off some of these things, we can help you with that. We can't legally help you with that the same way, because you're really supposed to be working in concert with your doc in order to get off those pharmaceuticals. So this is why we want to prescribe. And why should we be able to prescribe? Of course we should be able to prescribe. We should be able to prescribe because we are terrific practitioners, the kind of practitioner we are, because we treat the whole person. We listen to you. We listen to your concerns. We help you with your lifestyle. We want to get to know you. We have many things that can help you. And we're not going to use pharmaceuticals exclusively, pretty much ever. And the other side of it is, a good naturopath isn't going to judge you if you're like, hey, I take this pharmaceutical and it works for me. You come in and you're like, I had problems with depression, and you're like, I take my escitalopram, which is it's an antidepressant, and I take my 10 milligrams of escitalopram and I'm good, and I don't have depression. If I go off my escitalopram, I tried it, I went off my escitalopram, and I got depressed. But so I take my little dose of escitalopram and life is good. What do you think I'm going to say? Escitalopram isn't a particularly dangerous drug. I'm going to say, keep taking the escitalopram. And not only that, if somebody is extremely depressed and I've gone around the block with them trying to treat them, and I've done my MTHFR and I've done my genetic testing and my methylation and detoxification genetics on them, and we've tried all kinds of things, and they're still depressed, because of whatever's going on, we just can't get around their neurotransmitters, or their lifestyle is such where it's very hard to change it, I might want to try a low dose of escitalopram. Because you know what? The antidepressants, the SSRIs, I don't want to say that they're not particularly dangerous. They can be dangerous, and they're particularly dangerous in children and in young adults and in adolescents, because they can give you an over... they can give you too much serotonin, and then they can make you suicidal. So you have to be careful of that. But most of the time, in adults anyway, they don't do that. And if somebody's really, really depressed, you want them to not be depressed. That's why you have these drugs. So you want to be able to prescribe those things. Conversely, some people are like, I'm on these pharmaceuticals. I'm taking an atypical antipsychotic for my anxiety. And now I have tardive dyskinesia, meaning I have Parkinson's symptoms from my atypical antipsychotic. I want to come off it. I would like to be able to guide a patient through that. Or, so I can't do that right now in the same way because I don't have prescriptive authority. And that is something that we really, really want. So should we have it? Absolutely.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I'm sold. I'm totally sold. I agree. You know, there certainly are times when it would be nice if you could prescribe. It makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. So, but you have to get it by the, I don't know who you have to get it by, Connecticut Department of Health?
Yeah, that's who we're lobbying, the public health. And we, like I said, we get obstructed by the medical society. The Connecticut Medical Society is much more powerful. They have many more lobbyists. They have a lot more money, and they have way more physicians than we do.
And they're tied into the insurance thing.
And the insurance they're and the pharmaceutical
really,
company.
And the insurance and pharmaceutical thing is just a huge mess. And if you take a look at, hang on here, we've got, if you take a look at the current insurance commissioner, the current insurance commissioner worked for both Aetna and Cigna. So there's very, very strong ties with her to
industry.
The big insurance industry here in the state, and her husband is a lawyer for one of them.
Aww.
So it's like there's just so much controversy, and she, you know, there were some issues with her as far as this whole merger thing that went on with the big insurance companies.
Well, that's one of the things that the insurance industry is very strong in Connecticut. It's one of the biggest industries in Connecticut, you know, and that's one of the issues. So There's some issue that the insurance companies have it in their interest not to have us prescribe, which I don't understand. I mean, because the thing is, one of the big problems is that, like you said before, the family practice, the profession of family practice is dying. That people prefer to specialize because you have a nicer lifestyle and you get paid better than a family practice doctor. It's very stressful being a family practice doctor. And more naturopathic physicians tend to be generalists. I mean, even if you're someone who specializes, you're a naturopathic physician that specializes in a particular condition and you become known for that, you're probably still going to see some patients for, you know, I have a cold. I want to come in and get my cold treated. I have bronchitis for 2 weeks. Can you help me? You're still going to see those people and you want to be able to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I just want to throw out there, people are entering school again. I've already seen people sick.
Oh,
they're coming
no.
with colds.
Really?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Already?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Once you get people gang-housed, they start passing the germs around. So I just want to remind people that naturopathic physicians are great for your acute problems. We can treat your acute gastroenteritis. You have acute stomach bug. We're really good at treating that. And we're great at treating your colds and your bronchitis and your sinus infections and also your allergies. And by the way, the ragweed is fat and happy right now.
Oh, boy, is it ever.
So
I was actually just weeping the other day.
Yeah.
Without even knowing why. I was just, my eyes just and my nose just started pouring.
Oh, the ragweed
and
is ridiculous
like,
right now.
What is this? Where is this coming from?
It's
I have no idea. I wasn't having an emotional crisis.
The roadside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because we were riding our bikes and we're exposed to it all the time.
So you really need to do your neti pot. Neti pot really help. It's a good idea to pull out the old Eyebright and Euphrasia, vitamin C, quercetin, all of those things can be really helpful. And you know what else is a great herb? I was reading Susan Weed.
That's funny. Weed.
She did that on purpose.
Okay.
That wasn't her born name.
She
did that, and it's Sue Sun, S-U-S-U-N.
Oh, that's funny.
Right.
Susan Weed,
yeah. And she hangs out in Saugerties, New York, and she's brilliant. She's really, really intense, but she is brilliant. She knows science behind herbs, and she's very, very smart, and she's extremely articulate. Anyway, I was reading Susan Weed's take on goldenrod. Goldenrod, people think they're allergic to goldenrod, but you're not allergic to goldenrod. And I didn't realize why. And I had known the piece about people aren't really allergic to goldenrod. They think they're allergic to goldenrod because it blooms the same time as the ragweed. And people are allergic to ragweed as really nasty
goldenrod's far more visible because of its bright yellow thing.
Exactly.
Right.
That's exactly right. But guess what? There's a reason why. Goldenrod has very benign pollen and not a lot of it. And so you're unlikely to be allergic to goldenrod. And goldenrod is a wonderful herb to treat your colds and your allergies. And, so tincture of goldenrod or goldenrod tea or goldenrod as an ingredient with the other things is really helpful. And I want to order some goldenrod tincture.
Okay, you should do that.
All right. And then I'm going to go.
And then, you know.
So thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, and we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.